It's December 11th, 2014, and this is Janice Kaufman, and it's not personal, it's business. I'm here with Kelly Heenan Trumpor, founder of See Jane Invest, seejaneinvest.com, which is an investor dedicated to educating women who want to fund women-owned companies. Kelly is a longtime advocate for women increased representation in business and politics. She draws on her experience in D.C., lobbying on the behalf of National Association of Women Business Owners, supporting the Women Under 40 Political Action Committee, and recruiting young professional women to enter politics through the nonprofit she founded, Running Start, which equips high school, college, and postgraduate women with the skills they need to excel in public office. A frequent media commentator and guest speaker at numerous universities and conferences, she is dedicated to teaching young women how to navigate the world of business and entrepreneurship. She is a board member of the Baltimore Angels, a Maryland-based investment group, and holds an MBA from Johns Hopkins and a law degree from the University of Maryland. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Boy, that was an impressive introduction. So, Kelly, why did you start your website, See Jane Invest?
I started it because I think it's really important for the public to see a woman really owning the title of investor, especially angel investor. It's one of the things that I saw in politics. It's so important to model what you want to see as change. And I looked around Baltimore and I had all these friends doing incredibly creative, incredibly entrepreneurial things. Many of them were women. A lot of them were guys too. But I had a lot of female friends and they couldn't find money. And I was like, okay, well, how do you find money? I mean, I had to ask the question. And I have a law degree. I've gone through an MBA program. So I wasn't starting from scratch. I knew the kind of the outline of how this worked. But I had to ask, okay, where can I support you? Where could I be the person who maybe gets behind your company? And it occurred to me that if I'm asking these questions and I have the experience that I have, well, what are normal women doing who also want to help, but maybe don't know about business systems, investor world, politics, any of that. So I really wanted to model my experience, my journey, and just put it out there of like, hey, I raised my hand. I'm the guinea pig. And I put myself out there and said, I want to be an investor. And I'm not alone in this city. I mean, the Baltimore Angels, I was the second woman to join the Baltimore Angels. But in the last year, we've gotten at least two, maybe three new women who have joined. This is going to keep continuing. I am not going to be alone for long, and that's a great thing. But essentially, I just put See Jane Invest out there so that there would be a resource for people to just see somebody else having this experience of being an investor and saying, yeah, it's fun. It's good. I like it. Yes, it's complicated, and there's things to learn, but there's a lot of really good reasons to do it, and I'm glad I'm here. So, extend the invitation. Hope you join me.
Your background with your MBA and having a law degree, how does that play into this?
I just feel like I was fluent in a lot of the languages that other people don't have the opportunity to be as fluent in. Part of the investor process on my end is I get presented with a term sheet. And before you make an investment, you're signing your name on a pretty complex document. Well, for someone who's a lawyer, it's not that difficult. It's not that intimidating to say, I'll figure it out. That being said, I've still encountered documents where I'm like, whoa, what is that? I don't know it. I have to figure it out. I went into law school knowing that I wanted to be a lobbyist, knowing I wanted to support causes. I gravitated towards nonprofits. I wrote a book called Working at Interest Groups and Nonprofits about how this was an underfed career option. People weren't really looking at the ways that they could take their passions and make a living off of them while doing good work. And that was just one way that I think turned into what people know now as social impact. When you're saying, I want to do something, but I want to have my living be made around it or some profit stream. And I'm an advisor at the Impact Hub that's starting in Baltimore too. So there's this whole community here in Baltimore of people who are very interested in doing something that does the world good, but then also comes back around and can support something, whether that's an individual, a business, a community. You want to find the revenue streams along with the places of doing good. Right. So investing just was a natural evolution from my work in lobbying, my work in, you know, some of the social justice issues I used to work around, politics. It just kind of all fed into each other.
I am a woman business owner, so I think I know where you're going here with this. There's been some positives and some negatives being a woman business owner, and I would love to hear your take on what's going on in D.C., the good and the bad and the ugly, of course, and where you think things are moving forward with business and women in business specifically.
It's been actually a while since I've been in D.C. I'm based in Baltimore now, and Running Start, the nonprofit I co-founded, I dealt with a lot of women who had ambitions to run for public office. Before that, I used to lobby on behalf of the National Association of Women Business Owners. Mm-hmm. In most of my career, I'm in these spaces where I see women who want to enter the playing field, and they're either learning about it, they're unfamiliar with it, or they're finding barriers and they want to overcome them. When I've encountered women in business, I don't have necessarily a lens where I'm trying to say, hey, this should just be about women, because it's a lot of fun to work with guys and they're a wonderful collaborative force. But talking to women as a woman and seeing the problems that come up, I think for me as an investor, what I see all the time is that women typically don't think as big as guys do with their business idea. They tend to take an idea that isn't scalable. And there's nothing wrong with having your own business that's just your own, but there are so many more men who take a business and say, I want 100x returns on this business. Mm. Whereas women will approach it and say, I hope I break even. And I want to kind of change the thinking for both the investor who's a woman and the business owner who's a woman and say, you should want more for yourself and for the people you're helping with the profit that you're getting out of this deal, whatever side of the table you're on.
Well, I find it interesting as a woman business owner, I find that a lot of my clients are also women and we tend to sort of lift each other up. Do you see that being a reoccurring thing?
Definitely. I've had many wonderful women mentors. I've known so many women have helped me network, connect in my own career, and I just try to return the favor. And I think what happens is that women, when they do business together, I saw this in politics too, how they speak to one another, how they do business. I find it's more direct. It tends to, when you get down to the nitty gritty, it's like, where are we on this? You know, who wants to do something? Who doesn't? And there's less kicking tires sometimes. I don't want to be too general because I don't think any man or woman conforms to just a gender broadly, but I've enjoyed working with women. It's always been fun. They have great networking skills, and it's always a fantastic group of people. And I always follow the people. If I find interesting people, then I want to be involved with what they're doing.
So I'm curious, you worked for some politicians in Washington. Couldn't you drop any names?
Actually, I never worked for a politician in D.C. I used to work in college. I worked under Dennis Archer in Detroit. And before moving to Baltimore, Detroit was this wonderful testing ground for me. I actually studied Baltimore as a city footprint. Baltimore had taken the Inner Harbor and they turned it into this tourist-friendly place. Detroit back then didn't have that. They're still working on a lot of things. And Dennis Archer was a fantastic politician to work for. He's one of the mayors that I think Detroit can be proud of. And then, you know, working in D.C., I was working collaboratively with politicians. I was either lobbying them, asking them to help me with things, or I was helping them decide to run for office. I was taking budding politicians. And with all the other women I worked with at Running Start, we were creating programs around talking to high school and college women and saying, look, this is how you take it to the next step. This is why you should enter politics before the age of 40 and think about it as your primary career, not something you do after you've checked all these other boxes. And that was great because you get to see the best politicians, in my mind, are the politicians who are looking to do something that speaks to some of their passions, and they should get elected. They should be able to raise money. They should benefit from it. But they're always trying to return something back. And it was so much fun to see ambition meet this civic spirit and just be able to foster that.
Let's talk about what you're doing now, which is you're a board member of the Baltimore Angels Investment Group. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Baltimore Angels have been around for at least the last 2 years, and they have been doing investments in early stage companies, which just means when a startup has gotten off the ground and they've talked to their family and their friends about money and they've closed that out. We're the first people they usually talk to after talking to their friends and family, but we're taking on an equity position in their company. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of great people who came before me at the Baltimore Angels who have done so much to help Baltimore grow its entrepreneurial ecosystem. So it's a real pleasure to get to work with the men and women of the Baltimore Angels as a board member. And we have a lot of desire to take the Baltimore Angels into next year, the following years, make it a really welcoming place for entrepreneurs with an eye always towards making a profit for everyone involved. And that includes the city. You know, when we make an investment, we have an eye for what does this do for the area and for the local economy. So it's a lot of fun to work with those people.
You discuss on your website, cjaneinvest.com, crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of changes that are coming in crowdfunding. Could you tell our audience a little bit more about crowdfunding? Maybe they don't know much about it.
So the reason I got interested in crowdfunding is if you start talking about how do women start businesses, one of the ways that they're different than men is that men typically start a business with about $100,000 to $125,000. Women will start a business with $25,000. And in some ways, you can look at that and say, wow, that's really impressive. You're doing more with little. But on the other hand, it often points to the guys are thinking a little bit bigger, whereas the women are saying, what do I have right at my disposal? And not many people have more than $25,000 available to do anything. Not many people have $25,000, you know,
true.
But $25,000 is a totally different story than $125,000. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of women who gravitate towards web-based businesses or owning their own private businesses. Well, crowdfunding to me was the place where you go like, okay, if you're comfortable going to your immediate circle and saying, I need help starting a business, and I want to open it up and try to get it into that, even that $20,000, $25,000 range, which is about as far as I usually advise people to consider going with crowdfunding, especially as it exists now. You know, there is a way that you can prep your business if you have a scalable business. And by that, I mean you've got a product that somehow can multiply on itself and return profits both to yourself and anybody who may eventually invest in the company. Mm-hmm. What crowdfunding can do is it basically gives you this little litmus test of how's your idea working? You know, is it resonating in a market?
Right.
Do you know your stuff about getting your idea out there? And as it exists right now, crowdfunding is just no different than your local PBS drive. You know, when they interrupt the programming and you can get this cool umbrella if you call now and give $25. Right. When you give $25 to PBS, you don't own anything that PBS is doing.
Except for that umbrella.
Just that umbrella, which is basically a thank you gift. Mm. That's all you're getting. You are donating to a cause. And one of the ways crowdfunding is a little bit different is that if you're a business, what you don't get to offer the people giving you money is a tax write-off because you're not a charity, which PBS can offer that in addition to the umbrella. But you can do everything else. You can basically take the PBS model and say, I want you to support me and I will say thank you somehow. And that's what you get out of this, including the satisfaction of having helped me out. Isn't that great? Well, it's really not a bad idea for people who actually have a business that they may want to take to the next level. Mm-hmm. The most successful campaigns I've seen, Indiegogo is a great example, because Kickstarter is really good for creative professionals. They're not as good of a choice for people who are starting businesses because Kickstarter likes to keep them very project-based. They want it to have a beginning and an end, whereas many Indiegogo projects could be ongoing. Kickstarter also has an all or nothing. You know, if you don't raise the money that you say you're going to raise, you don't get to keep any of it. Whereas I think Indiegogo allows you to keep some of it. And those are just two platforms. There's others, especially for women. There's Plum Alley, which is really cool. Indiegogo has had many women-owned companies that I've seen, and the ones that do well typically go on and do really cool things. So from an investor's standpoint, somebody launches a campaign on Indiegogo. And it's not very different from running a political campaign. You have to plan for it. It's a job in itself. But if you do it right, as an investor, if I see that you have 500, 1,000 followers who funded your goal, and especially if you exceed your goal, it doesn't even have to exceed it by a lot, but if you just met your demand and then some, that's good to know, because it's like, okay, you're doing something that's resonating in the market.
Right.
Not to mention the Indiegogo platform basically gives you a little pitch deck. Your campaign, for me as an investor, gives me a snapshot as to, okay, who's on your team? What's your business model? What's your product? How are you trying to launch? Indiegogo and other crowdfunding campaigns have made it very clear. This is early stage. These are baby businesses. These are baby ideas. And they're basically coming around going, if you give me resources, I can grow this. But without the resources, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So you wind up getting these really cool products that come out of crowdfunding because people say, oh my gosh, that needs to exist. I want that to exist. And I've done that. I've backed campaigns where I'm like, I'm doing this because I want to be the first person who gets this product. And that's the thank you gift, is the first run goes to the supporters. Mm-hmm. I supported Wine for the World, which was a campaign on Indiegogo. And I loved it because it was a fantastic business plan. It was about pairing people from Napa Valley with emerging winemakers in third world countries. Mm-hmm. And you'd get these fabulously well-developed wines that were supposed to be really good tasting. And then you would also bring emerging entrepreneurs from emerging markets into mainstream first world economies. So it hit my social impact itch. It talked to my women-owned business. It was early stage, but it had all these great people behind it. And it was like, I'm putting my money behind this because I'm going to want to follow you. I'm going to want to know about your product. I'm your customer. It was just, it's like window shopping for investors. That's not to say that there's a lot to pick from, but I think crowdfunding is going to have some really interesting options for people in the future. Equity crowdfunding is on the horizon. There's still a lot of regulations that have to be ironed out before that's really a thing.
Right.
And right now it seems to benefit, it's really well poised to benefit people in, say, real estate. How much it'll benefit people in other businesses, it kind of remains to be seen.
Right.
But a lot of promise and a lot of potential, a lot of great platforms coming up around it.
Why do you believe that women make better investors?
When I say I think that women make better investors, a lot of the time what I'm talking about is their gut reaction. I would never say make an investment just based on a gut reaction. That's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. But when you think about how much market information has come our way, we are the most targeted population on the planet for our spending capabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, and from the time in utero, you are being marketed to. I mean, Target will get your mom on the list so that they can, you know, get the baby formula in your mouth.
Right.
And from there on out, your habits are chronicled and recorded and put in, you know, algorithms that companies will rely on to get inside your head and say, how do you spend your money? So if you've been faced with that most of your life and it comes at you in every single direction, you internalize how companies kind of work. You sort of understand, hey, this product's going to make it or it's not because I'm thinking about buying it or I'm not thinking about buying it. I mean, huge bellwether for me is if somebody pitches me a product I'm the right target for. I mean, if you come and pitch me something that NASA's going to use, I'm not an astrophysicist.
Right.
I can understand the product, but maybe I'm not in that space, so I'm not your customer. But if you pitch me something that I should be your customer or I am a potential customer and I'm like, nope, not interested, or I know no one that I would recommend this thing to, then I'm not going to invest, and it makes no sense for anyone who could say the same to invest. So I think women underplay how much their consumer instinct really informs them. But that's what makes them great investors. They feel out the situation, understand what's speaking to them about the product. And I don't want to just pigeonhole them and say, oh, what we're good at is just being consumers. It's just that that's been our habit. The other way that women are really fantastic investors is that I think that they want to talk to the entrepreneurs and know what the entrepreneur is looking for in terms of looking for help. You know, sometimes investors are there to be passive and just write a check. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're there to help you network, to help you find the next lead, to help you refine your business plan, your pitch deck. And I think all investors who want to be mentors step up. But women are fabulous at offering up their networks, connecting people like rapid fire. You know, they'll just plug people in. And it opens up a lot for an entrepreneur. And I think that's across the board, whether you're a small investor or a big investor, women are really ready to kind of go to work for you because they want to, you know, this was something I learned in politics. People don't bet against their own money. Mm-hmm. If you put money behind something, you want to see it succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think women especially go to it and say, no, I put something behind this. I want to see it grow. I want to benefit from it. And I want to help this woman too.
Well, I know you've had some experience with the National Association of Business Owners. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that organization? I know it's still out there. You know anything about what's going on with them right now?
It's been a while since I've been involved. I just know that when I was involved, they did a nice job trying to represent the woman's perspective in DC as a collective entity for women's voices. I was more involved with the Maryland chapter of it. I often went to their political days in DC, had a lot of connections through that, met some fantastic people. I think it was one of the organizations that I first encountered as a young woman that was banding around women's interests. And that's not to say they were the only one. They just happened to be the ones that I found first. And I knew that I was very interested in finding out more about, hey, what's going on in this space? And I kind of gravitated to them just to have a look-see of what they were doing. And they were happy to use my talents and say, yeah, let's put you to work and get you involved in some really cool projects. So I went to law school here. I found out about them, you know, late in my law school career. And it was just an early networking opportunity for me. And absolutely gave me a great starting place.
It's certainly been some changes in the past few years in terms of women business ownership and opportunities with federal government contracting with the WOSB program through the SBA. I know in the past, because I had to go through it myself, the 8A program, if you were a woman-owned business, you actually had to prove your disadvantage to the SBA. You weren't considered necessarily a disadvantaged business owner, even though the fact of the matter is that a man always had to co-sign a woman business owner's loan up to 1998. So there has been some changes for the positive. I know this is a program that was presented by President Clinton, and it took them 20 years to do the research on it until they determined that, yes, definitely women-owned businesses were disadvantaged.
Well, that was actually one of the things I lobbied on. That Clinton administration study was a focal point of my lobbying efforts.
Interesting.
They had actually, when I got to it, had conducted the study. Our notes said that it had been done, and they didn't release it. And it was like, wait a minute, you paid for a study, you have the data, but you're not releasing it. And there was sort of a, why wouldn't you release it? Maybe because it's not very favorable. Now, what happened is that I wound up having some career transitions, but 9/11 and everything else put that so far on the back burner. And by the time the dust settled to go back around and say, can we have that study from 20 years ago? Everybody was like, I don't think this is going to be as relevant as we want it to be for right now. I mean, it's still going to be informative about what was happening then. But hey, two decades later, things might feel a little bit different and the audience you're talking to might have more experiences. So I left it in, I think like late 90s, early 2000s. So I didn't hear really what happened after that. But I just thought that was a funny part of the whole lobbying process. It's like, wow, you did a study, you paid for a study, you don't want us to know what the study is, even though that was the point of the study, right, was to release it to the public. Okay, you know, how about that?
The WOSB program is active and it's up and operational. The amount of contracts that are actually going to WOSB companies, certified companies, versus 8A companies or minority disadvantaged business enterprises and such, that's a whole nother story.
Sure.
That's another report that they're going to end, that they're going to have to go through and get the numbers and actually see if it's being used.
Yeah. And I think that's something too that I tend to talk a lot about women, but women and minorities, they have a lot of similar struggles.
Right.
And minorities have more struggles than just being a woman. And I know many business owners who are women and of minorities, yeah, and it's like, wow, you know, there's a lot of things I think people take for granted, mm-hmm, that we get to do very easily, you know, if you haven't had that experience. So I'm glad that they always tend to work together because I think there's a lot of mutual interest. And
right,
I'm always excited when I see good things happening for all of them.
Kelly, where do you see yourself in a year, 3 years from now, and where you see Jane Invest?
What I'd like to keep doing is finding the companies that really speak to me, you know, putting my money behind them, putting my support behind them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in growing my portfolio so that I have a well-represented group of companies that show not just my interests, but do something to represent women as entrepreneurs, as mm-hmm, scalable entrepreneurs. You know, my first investment was with AlloView, which is a Baltimore-based company. It was started by Jess Gartner, and she was a friend. She still is, and that's kind of how I came to investing. And it's finding the AlloViews. It's getting more companies to stay in Baltimore the way she has,
mm-hmm,
and really bring the game up here, because that's so important that Baltimore play on a bigger playing field.
Right.
You know, we're good at what we do and we should keep doing it. But I think everyone in all the communities I work with, everybody wants to bring the city to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to see where it goes from there. And it's entrepreneurial driven right now. Every city is so dependent on the startup culture, and they should be, because the people behind startups are putting a lot of energy, a lot on the line. They're risking a hell of a lot more than I am with, mm-hmm, my money to get their dream into something that is a profitable living thing that can sustain itself. That's no easy thing.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of people think, oh, I'll just start a business. It's very hard. It's sleepless nights. It's maxing yourself out physically, mentally, emotionally, financially. It's taking on a lot. And if you want your city to grow and prosper, you really have to get behind the people who are putting it all on the line. And that still sometimes takes a selection process. And unfortunately, the worst part of being an investor is I can't say yes to everybody who,
right,
comes at me. I have to pick, and I have to pick very carefully, because I have to meet my own needs as well as the entrepreneur's needs. But if you curate that, if you get a really good selection of companies going and you throw your weight behind it, I really think cities can move up. And I've always been a fan of the smaller city. I think there's nothing wrong with staying in a small city footprint, but going as big as that footprint will take you.
Right.
There's no reason Baltimore has to be New York or D.C., but we should be Baltimore. I mean, we should be Baltimore and proud of it, but have so much here that we're bringing the people from Washington and D.C. and turning into our own thing.
People throw the term around startup.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is a startup? Is there a particular year-based, money-based?
If you think of people who have come out of Silicon Valley, if you think of the Steve Jobs, the Mark Zuckerberg, those kind of templates, they're people who took an idea,
mm-hmm,
and they built it into something that went huge. So that's kind of the big, big, broad stroke. What happened is there was a lot of inspiration from technology companies and other companies where it's, what about taking an idea and instead of basing it around one shop or one location or one set of customers, what if you assume it can go global? Now, not every business can go global. Not, mm-hmm, every business should go global. But there is this whole pipeline that starts with an idea. And once that idea is in play, you turn it into a business and you look for it to go big. Startups mean you're a company and you're at the starting gate and you're going to basically try to go as far as you can. And that should be an IPO. That should be you're on,
right,
Wall Street with your company, you know, you ringing the bell. all these other, you know, a publicly traded company is kind of like everybody's big, big dream, or getting acquired by Google with a giant, giant price sticker behind it. That's everybody's dream. And I think a startup says, I'm there at the starting gate. And just like you see sprinters kind of going down on their marks, the startup culture is everybody down on their mark, gun goes off, what happens next? And you have to sprint. You have to keep up with all the other startups, all the other runners in your field. You are going to be competing for air and money. You know, it's going to be who's listening to you and who's funding you. Not everybody makes it to the finish line. Actually, very, very few make it to the finish line. And there's all sorts of races to run. An IPO is just one giant dream. There are other dreams along that path, like getting acquired by another company. That can be a $1 billion thing. That could be a couple of $1 million. And that's still a huge success.
Right.
Anytime you're going to an investor, you have to know that the investor is going to be asking you, when do I get my money back? What's the exit strategy for me? So startups are used to talking like that. They go to investors and they're saying, you get your money back because I'm the bomb. My company is the bomb. Together, we are going to return amazing profits. You know, if they know how to pitch, that's how it kind of goes in big, big, broad stroke. And it's the investor's job to kind of weed that out and say, yeah, I buy it, or no, I don't. I don't believe what you're saying. So startups talk to investors with this idea that there is a massive money stream going to come their way and somebody gets bought out or gets a profit out of it. And we typically don't look for the ongoing deals. Like, I think what is missing from the landscape of how do you support and fund businesses is, well, what if you're a business that you don't really need to be bought by Google, but maybe you're doing a great thing for a local economy because, you know, you're kind of the foundation of, say, the middle class. You've been doing a lot of hard work. There's not a lot of investors who are going to take that and say, okay, I want to put my money behind it, because you don't know when you're ever going to get it back out. Even if you own a share, even if there's profit returned to you throughout the year, is it predictable? And this is why people have financial advisors. I have a financial advisor, and he knows all the companies on Wall Street that are available through his office, and he can do all that for me. So as an investor, I may not be looking for those businesses so much because it's not a great deal for me. It may not be, the time management of it is kind of hard. Not that these things don't exist, and a lot of investors will get behind smaller businesses. But when you're talking about startups, startups tend to be the things that start small with the idea of going big somewhere.
Why don't you tell us, Kelly, where people can reach you and how they can get to cjaneinvest.com. Obviously, you go to cjaneinvest, but any other contact information you might have.
Just check out cjaneinvest.com, and there's a lot of information on the website. You can contact me through there. There's a contact form, and you know, you can follow me on Twitter at cjaneinvest. I'm also at KK Trumpbore, so look forward to seeing you out on social media.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Janice Kaufman, and this is Baltimore Internet Radio, and this is It's Not Personal, It's Business.